Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Krepko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have Breitbart reporting on the explosive WikiLeaks revelation, which proves that Hillary Clinton had a hand in the Arab Spring color revolutions. The news outlet published a detailed and well-documented article based on WikiLeaks material and other open-source references to compellingly argue that Hillary Clinton not only knew that shadowy networks wanted to overthrow a bunch of Mideast governments, especially the allied one in Egypt, but that her State Department helped them organize with one another and hobnob in the U.S. The Alliance of Youth Movement Summit was announced in the twilight weeks of the Bush presidency and was spearheaded by Jared Cohen, a Bush-era State Department official who later worked with Hillary and then went on to get a job at Google, where it was later revealed that he had worked with the State Department in assisting Washington's info war against Syria. That's another topic for another show, mind you. But this character's main role was in linking together a bunch of anti-government groups all across the Mideast and elsewhere, and introducing them to one another and U.S. government officials, including, it can obviously be surmised, intelligence agents. Hillary not only continued this project, but after the so-called Arab Spring had turned into an Arab nightmare, her close advisor, Huma Abedin, who was linked by family connection to the upper echelons of the Muslim Brotherhood, wrote in another leaked email to Hillary that, quote, "I'm giving you credit for inspiring the peaceful protest," end quote, with peaceful written in quotation marks and obviously indicating sarcasm. Below this message was a forwarded, sensitive, but unclassified situation report about the violence that had broken out all throughout the Mideast during the week of the Benghazi attack. We can deduce 2 valuable conclusions from this reporting. First, that there is clear policy continuity between the Bush and Obama White Houses, and that the deep state, the permanent military, intelligence, and diplomatic bureaucracies that ensure international policy continuity amidst domestic political transitions, actually does in fact exist inside the U.S. And secondly, that Hillary, as Secretary of State, took the public lead in organizing the Arab Spring color revolutions as part of her duty in carrying out Bush-era deep state strategic plans. All this is relevant in the present day because not only does it vindicate analysts such as myself and many, many others who surmise that Clinton played an active role in all of this, but it also proves that if the U.S. organized a theater-wide color revolution before, that it could definitely do so again. Moreover, with the election season in full swing right now, this revelation further proves that Hillary is the ultimate Washington insider and a member of the deep state. Something which completely contrasts with Trump's image as the political outsider unadulterated by the government, and thus the only candidate capable of cleaning up the mess that the last couple of administrations created. The next one up is the referendum which just passed in Bosnia's Republika Srpska and the significance that this holds for Balkan stability. So the results are in, and 99.8% of the over 55% of voters that turned out for the referendum agreed that the Republic's Statehood Day should continue to be held on the 9th of January, just as it's always been. Without explaining the national and regional context of this plebiscite, you guys might be wondering what the big deal is and why we're even talking about this. But the fact is that this simple vote is actually really important and carries with it significant consequences for the Balkans. The Croatian and Muslim ethno-political members of the fractured federation had been pushing for the Serbs to celebrate the creation of their statelet on a different date, arguing that because this falls on the same day as an Orthodox holiday commemorating his patron, Saint Stephen, it is somehow discriminatory towards the Catholic and Muslim members of the country. Instead, they want to force the Serbs to celebrate their day on the 1st of March like the rest of the country does during Bosnia's Independence Day. But many Serbs retorted that not only is it illegal for Sarajevo to impose such a demand, but that this is discriminatory against Serbs, since many of them were killed in Bosnia on this very day and because of this declaration. In the run-up to the vote, and in an attempt to intimidate the Serbs like they always try to do, the Croats and Muslims got the central government to deem the referendum illegal and started a wild conspiracy theory that this was actually a secret vote for independence, which would technically be against the country's constitution. It was nothing of the sort, though it doesn't take a political genius to realize that if the Serbs could peacefully secede from the dysfunctional EU-controlled entity of Bosnia, that they would have done so a long time ago. So why is the referendum so important? Well, not only does it reaffirm the Serb's sovereign dignity, but the crazed Croatian Muslim reaction to it, coupled with the fanatical response that the US and EU gave by doing everything they could to scare the Serbs, demonstrates that the West can't stand it whenever the Serbs stick up for themselves like they did this weekend, and that they'd rather keep this demographic subjugated than have them break free. Geopolitically extrapolating from this conclusion and all the observations related to it, there is no doubt that the Kraut and Muslims were pretending that the Serbs were breaking Bosnia's law in order to imply that they could thus be held accountable for whatever else happens after their not-an-independence referendum, intimidatingly hinting at an outbreak of hostilities when Muslim leader Bakir Izetbegovic threateningly said, quote, "We have seen how Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, and Milosevic violate laws and how all of that ended," end quote. So why are they getting so worked up about this? Well, other than the fact that Russia supported the referendum and the West wants to spite Moscow in the new Cold War, there's another more local explanation. Croatia itself is run by fascist-adoring neo-Ustashe, just like Ukraine is run by their Bandera counterparts. And the Muslim part of the country is turning into a Salafist stronghold, with both sides being antagonistic to Orthodox Serbs. You might think this would make Croatia and the Muslims a failure of Western 1990s policy. But believe it or not, this is exactly what they wanted to achieve, and they've never been more successful. Third on our countdown is how India is mulling whether to pull a Tibet by granting a Pakistani Baloch separatist leader political asylum and citizenship, and possibly even recognizing him as the leader of a government in exile. Rahum Dagh Bukti of the Balochistan Republican Party has been living in self-imposed exile in Switzerland, where he approached the Indian embassy to file for his request. India hasn't officially confirmed whether it will agree to his request or not, but all indicators look likely for it to do so. And Indian media, all of which is influenced by the government to one degree or another, mostly through advertising revenue that it buys and indirectly funding so-called private and independent outlets, have been in a fit of joy over Bukti's request and are confident that Modi will agree to it. The reason for their optimism is that the Prime Minister unprecedentedly brought up Pakistani Balochistan in his mid-August speech commemorating India's Independence Day, in a symbolic move that was interpreted by many as implicitly supporting the low-scale separatist insurgency that had been dragging on for decades in Pakistan's southwest. Up until this point, the Research and Analysis Wing, India's version of the CIA and otherwise known by its initials, RAW, had been long denying that it had anything to do with the violence there, which Pakistan has consistently labeled as terrorism. So Modi's bold pronouncement marked a hyper-aggressive about-face that few could have expected. Taking it even further, the very fact that India is now openly mulling whether to give Bukti asylum and citizenship indicates that it is serious about destabilizing Balochistan as part of its hybrid war on the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, something which I've been talking about off and on for weeks here on Context Countdown and in many of my articles for the Moscow-based Katihan think tank. Giving a Pakistani Baloch self-described opposition leader asylum and citizenship will closely mirror what India did with the Dalai Lama, as several media outlets have already commented, and a few others even expanded on this idea by reporting that sources have informed them that India might even recognize Bukti as a leader of a government in exile. If India tries to pull a Tibet with Balochistan, it could lead to very far-reaching consequences, such as involving the CIA if they're not a part of this operation already. We shouldn't forget that the CIA was the mastermind behind the whole Tibet Dalai Lama operation and simply used India as a staging ground for its destabilization operations. So given the new and fast-accelerating military strategic partnership between India and the U.S., it can be expected that the U.S.'s intelligence services are, will, and have been playing a role in undercutting CPEC in its Balochistan terminal base. Depending upon how far American and Indian decision-makers want to go with this scheme, it could even one day be expanded to the in-country training of terrorist groups, just like they did against China in the 1950s and 60s. After all, at the end of the day, this is still a war against China, albeit one that's being fought indirectly. Our runner-up is how Iranian President Rouhani expressed eagerness for his country to take part in the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor and revolutionize Eurasian geopolitics. This news event will have long-lasting geopolitical repercussions and represents the infrastructural linking of the Mideast and South Asia, something which China has been trying to achieve for quite a while through its One Belt, One Road global policy of connectivity. Rouhani spoke to his Pakistani counterpart on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly last week and spoke about his intention to have Iran cooperate with CPEC. This is very important because up until this point, India thought that it had exclusive influence over Iran through the Chabahar port that it's financing to the tune of $500 million. And it's New Delhi's worst nightmare for Tehran to want to link India's investment with China's in Gwadar and potentially build a pipeline from Iran to China. India's view on the matter is entirely subjective, though, and it reeks of the zero-sum mentality that's so common in the West and the rest of the unipolar world. The objective reality is that Eurasia needs as much connectivity as it can get, and that this will help all parties achieve mutually beneficial trade advantages that can then assist with their developmental goals. Unfortunately, India doesn't see it this way, and it wanted Iran to remain exclusively focused in the North-South Corridor, not CPEC. But Iran just daringly proved that Prime Minister Modi and his powerful National Security Advisor Ajit Doval's plan of isolating Pakistan has been a major failure. Pressing the point even harder, Rouhani is on record as saying, quote, Pakistan's security is the security of Iran, end quote. This directly ties into the last section that we just discussed about India's plans for destabilizing Pakistani Balochistan. The Baloch ethnic group also resides in the neighboring Iranian province of Sistan and Balochistan, which is interestingly the terminal point of the North-South Corridor and the location of Chabahar. It's paradoxical that India would want to support the same sort of Baloch separatism in Pakistan that could easily go cross-border and destabilize its own $500 million port investment in Chabahar. Whether it's strategic ineptitude or, as former Indian ambassador to the U.S. Arun K. Singh introduced the world to last week, so-called Indian exceptionalism, we don't know. But what the Iranians do know is that this is a threat to their own security and long-term economic vision, which is why Rouhani so directly said that, quote, Pakistan's security is the security of Iran, end quote. Of course, this was likely said with the expectation that the world would see that Iran stands with Pakistan amidst India's reckless war gabble and the jingoistic media's call for blood. But analysts must also look at the deeper connotation of what Rouhani said as it relates to transnational Balochistan. So to wrap everything up, Iran is still an Indian ally. But just as New Delhi is practicing what it calls multi-alignment by militarily strategically teaming up with the U.S., so too is Iran doing the same thing vis-a-vis CPEC. But if India makes a big fuss about it, don't worry, guys. Just chalk it up to so-called Indian exceptionalism, the South Asian sibling of American exceptionalism. At our top spot, we've got the first presidential debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and how each of the candidates fared on their big night. So we've all seen it, read about it, or heard about it by now, and I'm sure that all the key quotes have incessantly cycled through the mainstream and alternative media by the time you hear this broadcast. So I'm not going to repeat anything that you guys have heard already. Instead, I want to approach this from a more general perspective and then hone in on how my thoughts relate to each of the two candidates. The debates aren't really what you guys think they are. Sure, both candidates are up on stage and presenting their opinions to millions of Americans throughout the course of an hour and a half. But the point of this exercise isn't to inform anyone of what they already know about each of the two nominees, but to engage in perception management under pressure. Think about that, guys. Did anyone learn anything new during the debates? Was anyone really surprised about anything that each of the two candidates said? Probably not, because you've heard it all before for months. But what's got everyone talking is how Trump and Hillary did, which, whether you yourself realize it or not, amounts to an assessment of how well they manage perceptions about themselves and their opponent under the intense hour-and-a-half-long pressure of a live debate. So if we take this as our criteria for evaluating Trump and Hillary, what do we get? Well, I'd say that we get a tie, to be honest with you. Each candidate reinforced the respective images that they've been trying to cultivate and deflected negative attention away from their perceived faults. Hillary boasted about her experience as Secretary of State, however atrocious and corruption-infested her time in office was. And, most importantly to millions of genuinely concerned Americans, actually survived without a coughing fit, or even worse, a seizure. Trump, on the other hand, continued his style of improvisation and bravado, albeit toning it down a notch in order to seem more presidential, at least in the traditional sense. Neither Trump nor Hillary succeed in altering the perception of the other, which might be either because so many Americans already have a set-in-stone judgment about them, or because they didn't want to swing too hard during the first debate and lose a surprise initiative later on. What all of this means, guys, is that the fireworks actually haven't yet started. Both candidates held back, but trust me, I doubt they will during the second, or at least the third, debate. Okay, guys, so there we have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning in and listening to my program. I hope you guys will share this on social media if you enjoyed what you heard, and I hope all of you have a really nice weekend as well. So, guys, I'll talk to you later, and I also hope you will tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.